Our study at this time begins in the 21st chapter of Deuteronomy, and starting with the 10th verse. In this passage, we have several details given of the law of Moses, and some of these laws and precepts are very peculiar to the law of Moses, and some of them we do not have a good explanation for all of the details and circumstances. Nevertheless, we're going to study about them and determine what we can from what's said here. In the 10th verse, when thou goest forth to war against thine enemies, and the Lord thy God hath delivered them into thine hands, and thou hast taken them captive, and seest among the captives a beautiful woman, and hast the desire unto her, that thou wouldest have her to thy wife, then thou shalt bring her home to thine house, and she shall shave her head and pare her nails. This situation here is one in which the army has gone forth to war against the enemies, and the Lord brought them the victory. That is, the Lord hath delivered them into thine hands, and thou hast taken them captive. So it's describing a dealing with the captives of warfare. And thou seest among the captives a beautiful woman, and hath a desire unto her, that thou wouldest have her to thy wife. So here a soldier sees a beautiful woman among the captives. He has a desire toward her. He wants her to be his wife. Well, he does not, or is not allowed to take her immediately. He cannot just cohabit with her. He cannot use her any way that he wants to. First of all, verse 12, then thou shalt bring her home to thine house, and she shall shave her head and pare her nails. And all the authorities seem to be agreed upon the fact that this bringing her home to the house was a period of meditation or cooling off, in which the man could decide if he really wanted to go through with this thing of making her his wife or not. It wasn't just an act then of a moment of passion, but it would be an act after having observed the woman over a given period of time. And she shall shave her head and pare her nails. This is agreed that is indicative of her giving up her idolatrous religion and preparing herself to become a proselyte to the Jewish faith. Now, we all know what it means to shave her head, but this phrase to pare her nails, there's some dispute as to exactly what that means. The word actually here for pare, P-A-R-E, means to trim or to cut. However, some of the authorities interpret this to read that she is to prepare her nails, which could either mean to cut the nails or to let the nails grow long or to even paint the nails. Now, in my estimation, since she was going to stay here for a full month, the nails are not going to grow too very long in a month's time. So it would either be that she's to cut her nails or she's to do some of the kind of adorning or preparation of her nails to signify, to symbolize that she was renouncing her idolatrous religion and ready then to become a Jewish proselyte. Verse 13, and she shall put the raiment of her captivity from off her, and she shall remain in thine house. Now, to put the raiment of her captivity off from her is, again, another symbolic way of renouncing her former life, her former nationality, so that she could become the wife of this Israelite soldier. She shall put off the raiment of her captivity from off her, and shall remain in thine house, and bewail her father and her mother a full month. So she spent a time of mourning, of bewailing her father and her mother, a time described here as a full month. So from the time the man decided that he wanted for a wife until he could actually consummate the wedding, there was a month period in which she did some changing. She put off the raiment of her captivity. She shaved her head. She pared her nails. And she bewailed her father and her mother. And no doubt this was a time in which she could make an adjustment. And the man could in all probability be able to decide anywhere along the line that he wanted to change his mind and not actually take her to wife. And after that, thou shalt go in unto her, and be her husband, and she shall be thy wife. And it shall be, if thou have no delight in her, then thou shalt let her go whither she will, but thou shalt not sell her at all for money. Thou shalt not make merchandise of her, because thou hast humbled her. In this 14th verse, we seem to have a situation in which if the man didn't have delight in her, if he didn't have pleasure in her, then he could let her go whither she will. She seemed to be a free woman. She was no longer under his jurisdiction. She was no longer a captive under his command. But thou shalt not sell her at all for money. He couldn't take advantage of her now in another way by selling her. Thou shalt not make merchandise of her because thou hast humbled her. He'd taken her and used her for a wife, and then he had no delight in her, and he then ceased to have her as a wife. This seems to be one of the laws that Christ spoke of in Matthew 19, in which he said that, and he's talking about putting Moses suffering them to put their wives away. He says, Moses suffered it to be so because of the hardness of your heart, but from the beginning it was not so. This was not in God's original marriage plan, but he did make an exception here during the law of Moses. We do not know all the details or ramifications of why. However, we do know that in times of war, there are many, many situations in which the soldiers have some kind of an affection for the local people among those whom they are fighting. They do have illicit relationships. Their actions bring forth unwanted children, and this is one of the terrible, terrible aftermaths of a war. And the war that we recently experienced in Vietnam is a very, very graphic example of this. So we do have a law here that provided for a man to be able to take a woman like this for a wife who was a captive, and certain rules had to be performed before this could actually take place, and he still had a way in which he could, if he had no delight in her, he could release her and let her go whither she will. In verse 15, we have another rather difficult situation to explain. If a man have two wives, one beloved and another hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated. Now here's a situation. A man has two wives. Under what circumstances exactly the law of Moses allowed polygamy, nobody's really prepared to say. There are not any real good ground rules for this. All we know from this is that a man could be in a situation in which he had two wives. Now, one beloved and another hated. This is similar to the case of Jacob with Leah and Rachel. To hate here doesn't mean that he literally despised or had a loathing for a person, but it simply means that he loved her less. He loved one less than he did the other. But they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated. He had children from both wives. And if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, the woman that he loved less, the woman that he had the least affection for, she happened to have the firstborn son. Now this man might in his own mind decide, well, I'm going to disinherit or reduce the inheritance of this woman's son, even though he is the firstborn, because I have more affection for the mother of the other son. But the law forbid that. In verse 16, then it shall be, when he maketh his sons to inherit that which he hath, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he hath. So the son that was actually the firstborn, even though he was from the woman that he didn't love, or didn't love as much as the other woman, or even he literally could have hated the son's mother, didn't matter. If this son was actually the firstborn, then he could not change the inheritance so that he could not inherit like the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he hath, for he is the beginning of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. So this one who was actually the firstborn is counted here as the beginning of his strength. He could not disinherit him. He could not make another firstborn in his place. He had to give him the right of being the firstborn son. In verse 18 of Deuteronomy 21, we have another situation that is very interesting. If a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that, when they have chastened him, will not hearken unto them. This is a situation in which a child refuses to be obedient to the parents. And the son is described as being stubborn and rebellious. This means that he is obstinate, that he will not yield his will to the will of his parents. He rebels. He wants to show that he does not have to be submissive to authority, especially to the authority of his parents. And consequently, he's described as stubborn and rebellious, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother. And that, when they have chastened him, will not hearken unto them. These parents are supposed to have tried. They're supposed to have done what is called chastening here to bring the son into obedience. But yet the son is stubborn. He's rebellious. He will not listen. He will not obey. Now, this is a situation that was not to be tolerated in Israel. And we find that in our society, this condition of having disobedient children is a very, very common condition. It is one that has weakened the backbone of the family and our society. We know that for a child to not be obedient to his parents also means that he will not be obedient to the laws of the land, and he will not be obedient to God. Because you have to start learning some respect for authority somewhere, and if you fail to learn that at home, chances are you're not going to have that respect other places either. This has to do with obeying the fifth commandment, which says, honor thy father and thy mother, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee, that thy days may be prolonged, and that it may go well with thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. So this is a command that had a promise attached to it, that it may go well with thee in the land which the Lord thy God shall give thee. Well, this situation then has come to light. This son will not obey the father and the mother. Verse 19, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him and bring him out unto the elders of his city and unto the gate of his place. And they shall say unto the elders of this city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. So the parents had to take this child, this son, and bring him before the elders of the city and bring the charge against him, that this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Now, this word glutton, as I understand the meaning in this particular place, means to be vile and lightly esteemed. To be vile has to do with being unclean or dirty, and lightly esteemed means that he is looked down upon in the community for some reason or other, and of course in this case it would be because of his actions, that he was a drunkard, a glutton and a drunkard. This is a case that comes real close to the families of people in our society today. Many, many parents have children who are guilty of being drunkards, who are guilty of taking some kind of drug and letting that drug influence their lives and their actions so that they then are looked down upon in the community. If we will be honest with ourselves, There is no difference in becoming drunken on alcohol or in becoming drunken on some kind of drug. And when this is used for the purpose of so modifying your behavior that you no longer can carry out your responsibilities to your family or to your community or to yourself or to your God, then it truly is a very grievous sin. Well, after the charge is made, verse 21, and all the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. So shalt thou put away evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. So that was a very stern and very final way to take care of this problem. The men of the city stoned him with stones that he die. He was put to death. And he says, so shall thou put away evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. This was to be something done in public. It was to be something that was so broadcast that all the rest of the nation, all Israel, could hear and fear, and they could take heed to themselves that they too not be guilty of this same sin. Now this was designed to put away this evil from among the people. It was also designed as a strong deterrent for any other son who would be stubborn and rebellious, and who would be a glutton and a drunkard, and who would not hear or obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother. And it's hard for us to imagine that if this punishment were carried out in our society today, it's hard to imagine that we would have the same number of children who would be so rebellious and obstinate as we now have. Now in verse 22, another subject, if a man have committed a sin worthy of death, and he be to be put to death, and thou hang him on a tree. This is a situation in which a man has been put to death. Now we want to think at first that this man has been hanged, and the hanging is what killed him. But as I understand the history of the Jewish people, they did not hang people to put them to death. They first stoned them to death, and then they would hang the body on a tree to make a public spectacle of them so as to deter others from committing the same crime. So if a man have committed a sin worthy of death, and he be to be put to death, and thou hang him on a tree. He's been put to death, then he's hung on this tree so that the populace may observe his condition. His body, verse 23, shall not remain all night upon the tree, but thou shalt in any wise bury him that day. Now he was not allowed to be hanged on the tree long enough to stay there all night. The day that he was hanged, that day he also was to be placed in the grave, for his body was not to be allowed to hang at night. And he puts in parentheses here, for he that is hanged is accursed of God. That was a curse, according to this law, the law of Moses, to be hanged like this. That was a curse. And he says that he's to be buried that day, that the land be not defiled, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. To leave this man hanging on the tree all night, or after dark, would be a defilement of the land. The man was already a curse because he had been hung there, and he was not to be left there. Now in Galatians 3:13, a reference is made to this passage in talking about Christ. Galatians 3:13, Christ hath redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree. Now we have been placed under a curse by the law. Verse 10 of Galatians 3 says, For as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone that continueth not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. So any person who fails to do all the things written in the book of the law, if he's under that law, then he is cursed. Well, in order for us to be released from a curse like that, then Christ became a curse for us. And he became a curse for us not by breaking the law, but he became a curse for us by being hanged on a tree. And consequently then, everyone who was hanged on a tree was cursed in the sight of God. So that's very interesting to note then that one of the ways that we are delivered is by virtue of the fact that our Savior, according to this law of Moses, became a curse, and then that consequently made him become a curse for us since he was crucified for us and for our sins and not for his sins. Now, there are some who say that this passage about not allowing the body to hang overnight was for other purposes, such as to honor the human body and not let it go through decay unnecessarily by letting it hang longer than was needed to achieve the desired results of making a public spectacle of this body of the criminal. Now we go into chapter 22 of the book of Deuteronomy.